Hi, thank you for giving me this opportunity. I'm Chirag. I'm a graduate student at UC Berkeley, working with Urosh and Martin. And today I'll talk about reconstruction of cosmological fields and forward model framework. And I'll discuss two applications, one on galaxy clustering, one on intensity mapping. So first, briefly, I'll start talking a bit about forward model in a general sense, and then I'll focus on reconstruction and these two applications. Just a sec. All right. So the next generation of in the next decade, we'll be probing the universe with a lot of different cosmological probes, and we have a lot of the largest surveys ever coming up online. We'll have CMB galaxy clustering, which I've been doing for the past two decades, gravitational lensing, which has become important over the last decade, and supernovas. And we are hopeful to be able to do cosmology with also novel probes like 21 centimeter intensity mapping and others. This list by no means is exhaustible, like there are more observables such as gravitational waves and other things, and neither is this list of surveys for everything. But the two surveys that I would like to highlight, which are most relevant for this talk, are the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, or DESI. This is a 14,000 square degree galaxy clustering survey, which will take a spectroscopic galaxy clustering survey. And over the 5 years, it will take spectra of 35 million galaxies and quasars. This is the largest spectroscopic survey we have. For comparison, the previous largest one was BOSS, which took spectra of 1.5 million galaxies. So this is a huge blow up in the number of galaxies that we'll have. And its primary objective is to measure growth of structures and baryon acoustic oscillations. So this will be, if you look at the black line here, this will be measuring the BAO growth with a sub-percent precision based on Fisher analysis. The other survey I would like to highlight, give a shout out to, is PUMA. So I'm pretty sure you guys will recognize the background. This is from CHIME, because PUMA is right now a concept experiment. But it is for people who are starting to think, how do you probe dark energy after DESI and LSST at the turn of the decade? So this is a 21 centimeter intensity mapping experiment going all the way up to post-ionization era, so like redshift 6. This is probably the most promising way of doing high redshift cosmology. The reason being, what I'm showing here is, say at redshift 3, you have the dark matter which looks like this. If you look at LSST or other surveys, this is how they'll be probing the galaxies. So you can see you lose a lot of large-scale structures here. The density of galaxies is not large enough. On the other hand, a 21 centimeter survey should basically trace the dark matter exactly as you go much further down in the halo mass when you're probing 21 centimeter. The vertical white stripes you see here is due to foregrounds. I'll come back to it later in the talk, which is basically the main part of the talk. But such an experiment, in principle, should be able to constrain growth and expansion history all the way up to redshift 6 with super high precision. So the red lines are basically what PUMA is predicted to give, and the other lines are essentially other spectroscopic survey that you'll have by 2030. So the point I'm trying to make here is basically, over the next decade, we will have unprecedented statistical power, and this will give you opportunity to make new discoveries. For example, this is basically forecast of LSST to constrain dark energy. Red is what you'll have from stage three experiments, and black is what LSST is predicted to give. So this kind of precision, if this ellipse lies at any other place except this point, like somewhere here, that basically means new physics for dark energy. So you have a lot of potential, but at the same time, you have, a lot of challenges. Like, to be able to use these kind of surveys and probes to their full potential, you have to answer some of these questions that I point out. This is, again, by no means an exhaustive list. But firstly, we need to think about how to combine different cosmological probes. So in the first slide, I showed you have five probes and more. They are all tracing the same large-scale structures, essentially. And you would like to combine them so that you can break degeneracies, make yourself robust to systematics and stuff. That's non-trivial. So what I'm showing here is that, so because they are tracing the same large-scale structure, if you combine them, the covariance for them will have off-diagonal components. This is just an example study where people try to combine galaxy lensing with galaxy clustering surveys. And generally, the way you calculate covariance for this is by running mocks and doing simulations. But in that case, you need super high fidelity simulations, which essentially are able to resolve all of these observables together to high precision. The second question you might ask is, what is the optimal summary statistic? So mostly, we have used two-point functions. But these are optimal only for Gaussian fields. What I'm showing here is a slice of the density field today, Eulerian density field that you would observe today, and this by no means is Gaussian. We know there is information in higher point statistics, but the question is, again, which of these is optimal, and if you would want to combine them together, how do you combine them together? Again, you go back to these questions of like covariances and how do you get the mutually exclusive information from one to another. And then also, the way we generally do analysis is you run a MCMC chain given a summary statistic. You write down the analytic likelihood of that summary statistic, and from that MCMC chain, you try to recover the posterior of the parameters. This is essentially constrained based on how accurate your analytic likelihood for this thing is. So the point that I'm trying to make is essentially, if you want to get the full potential of these new surveys, you need to come up with new novel analysis techniques which answer these questions and others that people are thinking about. So one way of approaching this is essentially forward modeling approach. This is by no means the only way of doing this.
Can I ask you, sir? Yep. So you said dire need for novel analysis techniques. Yep. So that means dire usually means that if you don't do it, you're gonna die. So what is the dire situation?
Okay, that's probably a bit extreme. I give you that. But
is there something fundamentally wrong with what we're doing right now?
No, but we have a lot of potential, and you're spending a lot of money on taxpayer service for this. So if you're continue doing the analysis the way you're doing, that's kind of like, in some level, unfair, I would say. But yeah, you're right. There's no dire need, but it would be better if we can come up with new analysis techniques.
Your funding could be dire, you're saying.
Exactly. See, so that's the livelihood of all the people in here. Right. So one way people have been thinking about this is like forward modeling approaches. The basic idea here is that instead of putting all your eggs in the same basket of analytic likelihood of a summary statistic that you come up with, instead, you can go back and you start to model the full forward model for the observations. What you do here essentially is you break up your forward model into different components. You parameterize each component such that it is tractable. And then you try to basically constrain the parameters for all those components separately. This allows you to combine different observations. You can share the parameters which are like common to the pipeline for different probes. And since you're modeling the observation, in principle, you can also compare things at the field level. You wouldn't do that maybe, but that's an option. The reason why these kind of approaches have been challenging is because you have a large number of latent parameters here that you will have to constrain in this case, which has so far been intractable, but over the last couple of years, there's been a progress in high dimensional inference. These are just some of the approaches that people have come up with for this. And all of these approaches essentially benefit if you have fast differentiable forward simulations that you can use to do these kind of analysis. So I'll come back to this point at the very end of my talk, if time permits again. But the way...
you'll explain what it means? It's exactly differential forward simulation. Do you think you can take a gradient? You can take a gradient with respect to each of these parameters?
Yes, that's the idea. So for example, if you just, the most common approach is probably MCMC. You can do Hamilton Monte Carlo, which is much more efficient than doing a regular MCMC if you have a differentiable forward model, I think. So that's the idea.
Why does it have to be differentiable?
Talk about this thing. When you're doing an MCMC, if you have a Hamilton Monte Carlo, then you can go along the direction of gradients, and then the probability of keeping the next sample increases by a lot. It's just much more efficient. So when you are doing inference in high dimensions, you need it to be efficient. Otherwise, you'll not get the correct posterior in reasonable amount of computational time. So the way I've been approaching this is in a similar spirit. That's basically reconstructing cosmological fields in a Bayesian framework. using forward models. So the idea here is simply this, that you start with the initial conditions. So the objective of this approach is to essentially reconstruct some latent cosmological fields that you can use for secondary analysis. So the fields can be initial density field that you have reconstructed, or you can just reconstruct the data that you have observed by reducing the noise in there, or you can reconstruct hidden fields such as velocity field or final matter density field that can be used for supplementary analysis. The way this approach we have been framing is essentially this. You start with the initial conditions, you forward model all the way to your data, and then you compare it with your observations given a noise model. So this gives you the likelihood term. So if your likelihood is Gaussian, it will look something like this. And then you combine it with the prior on the initial field, which we know is Gaussian because of theories of inflation. And then you want to maximize this posterior to get a map estimate of the initial conditions. Once you have the map estimate, you can again forward model to reconstruct any of these latent fields that you're interested in. So that's the high-level approach of this thing. The challenges here are, again, the same. First, you have a high-dimensional optimization, because now what you're trying to do is reconstruct the initial conditions over the whole space. So for any reasonable simulation, you'll have like at least a couple million points. And so those are the number of free parameters you have. Again, the only hope you have of getting this to work is if you use gradient-based approaches for optimization and use differentiable forward models. The second challenge, which I'll again come back to at the end of my talk, is what likelihood to use. Like, I'm showing an example of Gaussian likelihood here, but what is the correct likelihood for the observable that you're using?
What are you including in the noise model?
This basically depends on the observations that you are focusing on. So
what is it systematic of the observations?
It should, in principle, you wouldn't, yeah. In principle, you would include everything, modeling error and systematics and instrumental noise and like fundamental noise.
And modeling.
Everything, yeah. So I'll discuss noise model for the two examples that I'm showing in detail.
Don't you need a one-to-one mapping of the initial conditions or the final conditions?
This is essentially the PM simulation. I'll discuss the forward model. So you'll have one-to-one mapping here. Right, I mean, to make things more concrete, like to look at how the forward models we use generally in cosmology, we start with the initial field. You run a PM simulation to get Eulerian dark matter density field, so I think that's what you're asking. And after that, the most commonly what we do is essentially run group finding algorithms like FOF or something to get dark matter halos. And then you do some semi-analytic or HOD kind of approach to populate those halos with galaxies or 21 centimeter intensity or whatever your observable is. So this is mostly used for these two approaches, and for other, if you have a different observable, this might differ, but generally, for the purpose of this talk, this is the approach that people generally use. Now, this step here is essentially differentiable because this is just linear evolution of, this is just the n-body evolution, which is just differential equations, which can be differentiated. This approach, the way we have been doing and to generate mocks and stuff, is non-differentiable. And this step is also stochastic. So basically, for our purpose in the next two parts of the talk, I'll essentially develop a differentiable step for this thing and then use that for reconstructing cosmological fields.
Normally, when you view the observables as being a compression of the information in the original linear field, because information is lost at various stages along that path,
yes,
you violate the uniqueness that the thing.
Yes. Right.
Originally, are you proposing to insert differentiable steps that will stop this being a compression?
No. So, I mean, most of the information, like for example, one place you lose is essentially at this step because you have shell crossing. And so the solution is unique only up to that level. So the solution what you get here is by no means unique. And when you are using the reconstructed fields for analysis, you need to include those kind of things in your analytical framework that you have some error bounds or covariance on the reconstructed field. So yeah, the solution that you get here is not the optimal, but well, it's probably optimal given the sense how much information you lose here, but it's by no means unique and correct. Like, if you look at the posterior, like just given the prior term here, you are never going to get the correct initial condition that is here. So,
So I mean, the statement about the first step being differentiable, I mean,
yeah,
principle, that's true, but the more nonlinear things are in practice, the less true that gets.
Right. So it's a scale dependent statement. Generally, as you push to much smaller scales where shell crossing dominates and stuff, you do not get back those things. And the hope is that the prior term will essentially regularize that to bring those things to zero instead of giving you something else. Yeah. So that's a that's a scale dependent statement. Okay. So that's coming to the first example, which is the 21 centimeter intensity mapping surveys. So here the so this was the figure I showed in the beginning, which basically promised that 21 centimeter is the most promising technique for high redshift surveys. So these vertical dash lines here are, so these surveys are dominated by orders of magnitude foregrounds, as I'm pretty sure everyone in the room knows. In principle, you can model away those foregrounds by just some modes along the line of sight. So in principle, that should give you these vertical bands. What happens is because of the leakage between leakage of the instruments, these foregrounds, these bands essentially show up as a wedge in the Fourier plane. So I'm showing a Fourier plane here as k perpendicular, k parallel, and at redshift 2, 4, and 6. If you see these dashed gray lines, this is these are the foreground wedge, and you lose all the modes which are essentially below this, below these gray lines. So depending on if you're optimistic or pessimistic, you can pick up either of these two lines, and that would be your foreground wedge for, in principle. So for the purpose of this talk, I'm not interested in modeling the wedge. I'm going to use a sharp cutoff as my wedge and just throw away all the modes which are within the wedge. And what this essentially does is that what your true intensity map, which should have looked like this, ends up looking like this. The reason why it is different in Z and Y direction is because you also have thermal noise, which is anisotropic, and it which is anisotropic in like X, Y, and Z direction. Right, so what this does mathematically is that if you put a foreground wedge at redshift 2, 4, 6, depending on your outlook in life, you can lose between 7 and 88% of the modes. If you further include thermal noise and remove the modes which have signal to noise less than 1 but are outside the wedge, so essentially these purple and black points, you lose further somewhere between like 9 to 40% of the modes. So this is a huge loss. Like at redshift 6, in the pessimistic view of life, you're losing 95%, 97% of the modes. You would somehow want to recover these. And the way we propose to recover these is like by exploiting the mode coupling between small and large scale of small and large scales that is induced by the nonlinear evolution. So the idea is pretty simple. You compare your model with your data on the small scales and your observations. You go back and you reconstruct the large scales in the initial conditions, because in the nonlinear evolution, information flows from large to small scales. And then you propagate it further ahead, and you get reconstruct the large scales in the observed data. So this is right.
So why wouldn't the foregrounds have that as well? And the foregrounds can have some bispectrum, which can couple small scales.
Right. So I'm currently throwing away all the wedges. Like I'm assuming that I have thrown away the modes in the wedge, which take care of all the foregrounds.
So you're not trying to recover the modes in the wedge?
I'm trying to recover the modes in the wedge, but the information for that is entirely induced by the nonlinear evolution here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're assuming there's no foregrounds outside the wedge?
Yeah. So that's why, and that's why we have these two assumptions. Like, I'm just trying to put the most conservative estimate and like just throw away wherever I think is foreground contaminated.
Is this done for some fixed values of the cosmological parameters? Or
yes. Yeah. So for now, like all of this, we have, it's also for fixed value of cosmological parameters as well as like fixed bias model, as I'll explain in the beginning. So so you would in principle not want to use this to do some kind of like autocorrelation studies, but you can, I'll show later that you can use it for cross-correlation studies and stuff, and like things which you are confident about at like fixed cosmological parameters. in the grand scheme of things, in the future, I would like to open up these boxes so that I can also constrain cosmological parameters with this, but we are not there yet. Okay, so first thing you need is a data, and to get data for 21 centimeter is notoriously hard. So we ran simulations, we ran a suite of simulation called Hidden Valley Simulations, which is 1 gigaparsec boxes with 10,000 cube particles. These are publicly available for use if people are interested on this side. And this is what we get. So we ran this between redshift 2 and 6. This is what the 21 centimeter data or neutral hydrogen content should look like. Essentially, we populated the halos with 3 different models, model A, B, and C. These are some combination of HOD and semi-analytic method. The whole point is to see how robust your assumptions are regarding this. What you find essentially are these are the 3 important things. Firstly, is that the 21 centimeter, the H1 content of the halos follows halo mass pretty well. And because of that, most of the signal comes from the halos between 10 to the power 10 and 10 to the power 12, which you would expect because you have way more halos in this mass range than you have at the high mass end. And as a result, the H1 content in the satellite is almost negligible for small mass halos, and it increases over the large halos, but overall this is quite subdominant. The advantage of this is that you do not need to worry significantly about finger of God effects on like up to much small scales as compared.
What effect is it?
The finger of God effects, because you have the redshift. So this is much severe in galaxy clustering, but for 21 centimeter, we hope that this would not be a problem up to much small scales. The advantage of all of these things is that the H1 field essentially traces dark matter very closely. So what I'm showing here is a snapshot for the dark matter field and the 21 centimeter and the H1 field for 100 megaparsec scale and like 10 megaparsec scale. And you see that the field is almost continuous and traces the dark matter very well. As a result of this, what you can do is for the forward model, you can use a bias model to get the 21 centimeter marks. So the bias model that we use is Lagrangian bias model. I'll run very quickly through this. What you do is you essentially weight each of the particle with their Lagrangian field. So you have 3 Lagrangian fields at cubic or at quadratic order, delta, delta square, and shear. So you have 3 corresponding bias parameters. You displace those particles to the Eulerian position, or in our case, redshift space position, with some n-body dynamics. So this can be your dynamics of choice, PM, ZA, or 2LPD, or other mock dynamics that you are interested in. And then you just put those things on the grid again, so you get your prediction for the 21 centimeter model. And then to fit the bias parameters, you just compare it with the true data, and so the way we do it is essentially we compare things in Fourier space and we try to minimize this error function to fit for the bias parameters up to some scale, okay? So this part essentially is trying to replace here the 2 steps that I showed in the beginning of like group finding and then populating things with an HOD and making the forward model differentiable in this case.
So there's no tidal bias in your model?
No. I mean, this is the tidal bias.
That is the tidal bias.
This is shear.
Sorry.
Yeah,
G
is basically tidal minus delta square. I've projected out such that they are orthogonal to each other. But this is supposed to be the tidal bias. Sorry. Right.
So you're doing this on the simulation.
Yeah, so right now I have not gone for the reconstruction yet. Right now I'm doing it on the simulations where I have my true H1 density field. So I have not put any foregrounds, no wedge. I'm still building my theory to the end of it, I think. Okay, so to see how well the bias model works, we essentially, this is the bias model I said, currently demonstrated. You can also use the Eulerian bias where you just upweight the Eulerian density with the bias field. So all the fields that I'll be comparing in the next couple of slides, I'll be showing the cross-correlation and the transfer function for 2 fields. So what I'm showing here is cross-correlation and transfer function for the true data H1 field with my bias model for these 4 different cases. And the best one that seems to work is ZA, which essentially is 90% cross-correlated up to like K of 0.8 or something. This is good enough for our purposes because as you go to further small scales, you are anyways thermal noise dominated. So you're not going to get much from there anyways. One obvious question is why ZA works better than PM is because the PM that I'm showing here is approximate PM simulations. These are not the exact PM dynamics I used to generate my data. That was a 10,000 cube simulation. This is a 512 cube simulation on the same box and also less number of time steps. So I would say in this case, we just got lucky that ZA was working better with PM. But in principle, you can do the whole analysis with any kind of PM steps. Nothing will change except it will be slightly more costly. Right. So the next thing you see, want to see is like the error power spectrum that we are minimizing. It turns out that it is.
Sorry, what is that vertical line? Because you don't have numbers on that line. You have number down. Is that same vertical line in all of them?
This is going from zero. Oh, sorry. This is. You mean horizontal line?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, there's a vertical dashed line.
Oh, the vertical. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
The vertical dashed line is the K up to which I was fitting my bias model.
Which is?
I think it's K of 0.3. Yeah.
0.3.
I see. So I fit for my bias parameters up to this K, but it kind of works up to like much higher K as compared to that. Right. So the error power spectrum that I was minimizing is essentially white for the ZA model. And this error power spectrum gives you the modeling error that you would that we are making. So this motivates the loss function that we have, which we need for reconstruction. And you essentially just you assume a Gaussian in the Fourier space for your likelihood. So you have the P error power spectrum, which I was showing before, and because you also have a thermal noise. Under the assumption that the noise is independent of your modeling error, you can just add those two variances, and this becomes your likelihood function for this case. Also, you'll be summing this only at the modes which are outside the wedge. So in my likelihood, I'm throwing away all the modes which are inside the wedge and putting a hard cut. If you have a good enough model for your wedge that you trust or for foregrounds, then you can, in principle, use those by changing this. But this is the most conservative thing you can do. The prior, instead, you sum on all the modes that are available in the spectrum. OK, so this is basically it. Now you have the posterior for the initial conditions. You would just go ahead and maximize it. Except when you just maximize it, it doesn't work because it's a high-dimensional optimization. So you get stuck in local minimas and stuff. So we developed some adiabatic optimization and multigrid schemes, which I'll not talk about. If you're interested in optimization, I'll be more than happy to chat about it later. But once you do that.
Sorry, before you go on, I want to know that expression. So what is that? What is n modes of k?
Oh, that's just the k that I have in the bin, in the Fourier bin. So these things are vectors, but I'm just calculating the power of this. So this is. Like when you take the, this is the a number of modes in the bin k,
that's
scalar bin k.
Numerator, not
denominator.
The n modes.
I think since this is getting summed over all the modes inside the bin, I'll be dividing, because this is average power inside the bin. So I'm kind of just multiplying the average power inside the bin with the number of modes. Yeah.
But the more modes you have, you should be better,
not worse. But each of them will be suppressed by error, right? So. Right. So this is So this is basically the money plot. Well, not yet. What I'm showing here is the cross correlation between the true H1 data field and the corrupted H1 field that I have, which has thermal noise. So you're missing all the large scale power because you have thrown away all the modes along the line of large scale modes. On the intermediate scales, because you lose more modes due to the wedge, you do not get the cross correlation of one. And I'm showing here results for optimistic and pessimistic wedge, so you lose more cross correlation for the pessimistic case. On small scales, you have thermal noise, which is suppressing your cross correlation. So this is the cross correlation between, and once you do reconstruction, this is essentially what you recover. So, you can see that on all scales, you essentially recover more than 90% of the modes. and you do better in case of the optimistic considerations as compared to pessimistic considerations.
What's the difference between the previous slide and this slide? So previous slide was...
Oh, this thing?
Yeah, this one.
Yeah, so the dashed lines here are the same. The thin lines here are the same. This is for the corrupted data. So if you just take your data and you cross-correlate it with the true field, this is in the thin lines, and this is with the reconstructed field, I think. So yeah, essentially, the point of here showing is like, where you even where you did not have any modes, you get back 90% correlation back in this case. Right, and then small scales, because of the noise, you have the damping, and also because your model is not accurate, so you do not reconstruct as well as you would otherwise on the small scales.
What is TF? What is the thing on the right?
This is the transfer function. So this is cross correlation and this transfer function. This is the ratio of the power square root, I think. Okay.
So
yep.
In real data, you're going to have small scale foregrounds outside the bench as well, right? Or is that?
Yes. Yes, we have kind of. So outside the wedge, you're saying. Sure, I guess you can also throw them away. I'm not sure. Kind of depends on like what scales you put them in. That will also.
You have like the reconstruction being biased by the presence of small scale foregrounds outside the wedge, like Sam was saying. Like,
yeah. So, I mean, even this reconstruction is biased. Like, I do not have power one on all scales. So, because you have thermal noise on scales, the reconstruction is biased anyways. You're talking about the noise bias,
yeah,
right?
So the correlation coefficient you reduce because you have...
yes. So, depends on, like, on what scales you're putting in. If it's on very small scales where our modeling error is anyways significant, then maybe it will not affect. But if you have it on the intermediate scales where you trust your modeling, in that case, it will, yes, bring down the reconstruction. Yeah.
I think the amount of contamination isn't really known, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the key uncertainty. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Same
sure. Yeah. The same is true.
The foregrounds
of
the galaxy here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can't just like model these small scale foregrounds with some very general models.
I think with a perfect instrument, they shouldn't be anywhere outside the wedge. But some, if you don't exactly understand your instrument, then there will be some leakage outside the wedge.
In some way, that can't be modeled.
That's
an open question. I think.
So yeah, that's the.
Like you'll need to look at running experiments like error or time to see like how precise does your experiment need to be in order to reduce the foregrounds to a certain level outside the wedge. So
you can kind of see like that's why I have two different. Options of wedge, like optimistic and pessimistic. I'm hoping that there's nothing outside the pessimistic wedge because I'm already throwing away 80% of my modes in that case. So, yeah, I mean, you need some information somewhere to do reconstruction. But yeah, this kind of shows you what you are asking. Like, if you have things outside the wedge, how much you lose? It turns out not that much at redshift 4 for the two configurations I picked. But this is the whole point here is like to, yeah. Pick out the machinery that you can do this, and then you can definitely improve on this. So some science cases that you can do is one of the things you can do with this is do clustering redshifts to constrain photometric redshifts for surveys like LSST, which can be super cool because for LSST, you do not have any other spectroscopic tracer beyond redshift 2.5 or 3. And for this, you need to have large scale modes along the line of sight. Because one way, so you can see this here as the one way you would model a photometric sample is by putting a damping kernel, which goes like this. So you need to have large scale K at low enough mu, which is basically the large scale modes along the line of sight in your spectroscopic sample, which we just reconstructed in 21 centimeters. So what I'm showing here is the noise over signal for this kind of cross correlation. And the blue is the line of sight bin. So if you take your corrupted sample, you are completely noise dominated, but after reconstruction, you essentially get back the signal in the first bin. So you can use this for clustering redshifts. The exact same argument applies if you want to cross-correlate this with CMB lensing. The other thing you can do is, even though I said you would not probably use it for autocorrelation studies, but if you want to, you also reconstruct the initial field along with this, and you can use that to do BAOs. So what I'm showing here is along the line of sight and perpendicular the reconstruction, This is our method. This is what a standard reconstruction would give you. The point I want to stress is that standard reconstruction does not reconstruct anything within the wedge because there is no information there. I'll talk about this in more detail for the galaxy cluster. Okay, so this was intensity mapping. More questions for this? Otherwise, I'll switch gears. Okay. So for the galaxy clustering surveys, going back to what our data looks like, this was my final matter density field, and this is basically a snapshot for my halos. This is fundamentally different from the 21 centimeter intensity field. The reason being, the galaxies and the halos that you have here are discrete samples, and your observations are like very sparse as compared to a continuous field that you had in 21 centimeter. So you can still use Bayes model for this. It works. But what we tried to do was something different and use neural networks to get the forward model here. So the forward model here is a simple, basically two simple two-layer fully connected neural networks. They are quite small. One of them has like 2,000 weights. The other one has like 500 weights. So no deep learning here by any standards. The input features that I had for this were basically handcrafted. And I used density fields smoothed at different scales and non-local densities. So for example, if I want to predict the halo at the central point, I used density at all the, in a cube around it, so all the 27 nearest points to get my, as my input features. The idea being that if your halo is supposed to be forming at a peak, then looking at 3 points in any direction should essentially tell you if there is a peak there or not. That was the motivation. And to tackle the sparsity of this sample, we made a two-step procedure. So we had one network which was doing classification. It essentially outputs a mask of like one and zeros where it thinks there is a halo. And the second network was doing a regression which essentially gives you the halo mass. So it essentially is just upsampling all the high density points to get halo masses. And when you combine the two, what you get is a halo mass field. So you have the points which do not have halos in this case are exponentially suppressed, and you essentially have a discrete field while maintaining the while maintaining differentiability in this case. Okay, so the next thing you need is the likelihood function. So the likelihood function we just calculate on the smooth version of this field. So this is the exact same field that I've just smoothed with Gaussian kernel of 3 megaparsec, and if you calculate the error histogram for this, we found out that a log normal, a shifted log normal, works very well. So I just take the log of these two masses. M0 is a constant factor that you can vary during the optimization. So this goes back to the adiabatic optimization that I talked about in the beginning. We use this for that to essentially suppress the low mass halos where our model is not accurate enough. So by no means you would expect this kind of likelihood. Like this is by no means a first principle likelihood. We just ran this on simulations and found out that it fits. So I like to talk about this in the next part of my talk. But this is a Gaussian log normal likelihood that we use for this. Right, so you combine this again with the prior on the initial conditions and you do the reconstruction. So if you have a data which So this is essentially, let's assume that this is my data field, so initial conditions, the final matter field, and the observations here. You start with some random initial conditions which are not correlated at all with the true field and also do not have the correct power. And you run the optimization and this is what you reconstruct. So you essentially reconstruct the final field and the halos quite well. The initial field you reconstruct back accurately on the large scales while the small scales are washed out because they are noise dominated. So that's the Wiener filtering. At the level of two-point functions, this is how it looks like. So this is, again, the cross-correlation and the transfer function between the initial field and the halo field that you have reconstructed for different number densities. So you reconstruct up to like 80% up to KF 0.4, I think, here. I'm also showing results for a different cosmology. So if I train my neural network at one cosmology and my data comes from a different sigma 8, it turns out that I get back the same reconstruction. So your neural network is somewhat agnostic to cosmology, but you need to test this more. Like we need to test this more. This is just one of the examples. and you just do it for different realizations and you find that you get the same thing back, which is kind of encouraging. On the same time, you reconstruct the halo field much more accurately as compared to the initial conditions. So this is 90% correlated up like F.8. I'm not showing here reconstruction for this guy, but it follows very closely the halo mass field. So if your latent field is the final matter density field that you want to reconstruct for, say, something like lensing, then you can use that in this case.
So for the wrong transfer from, so for the wrong sigma H,
yeah,
this method still recovers the right amplitude of the power spectrum.
Right, in this case it does, yeah.
But isn't that surprising? I mean, like, so if I train on the wrong sigma H,
yeah,
then shouldn't I be getting like the wrong amplitude of the modes at the end? Because I guess I don't understand how it's possible for it not to fail.
If you have wrong sigma 8, then you have wrong. If you have a different sigma 8, the way I think about this is like so what the neural network is doing is essentially just taking some peaks and saying that you have the halos. If you have a different sigma 8, you just have more peaks and so you just get more halos kind of thing. So it's in some sense agnostic in that way. But I kind of agree with you that even I found this surprising and I would like not just use this for analysis immediately. It has to be like verified. And sigma 8 is probably one of the easiest things to make it agnostic to. If you change omega m and stuff, it will be harder to get the correct same answer in that case. But like I would not throw my money at it right now, right away, that yeah, this thing will work out of the box for this. The point I'm trying to make here is that it is encouraging that it can be done, is what I'm saying here.
Initial conditions, the map of the initial conditions, is that part of the output layer that it's trained on?
No. So again, in this case, my neural network is just replacing my friends of friends and HOD in this case. In fact, this is reconstruction from the halo, so there is no HOD, so it's just replacing the friends of friends. So my forward model is a PM simulation and a neural network. And then for my reconstruction, like every time I run the loops, I get a estimate for the initial condition, do an evolution, pass it through the network, compare, and then propagate the gradients back to the initial conditions.
One more on that. So you're showing the power spectrum. Have you looked at the PDF of the initial conditions? Can you, for example?
If you're asking, it was Gaussian. For large enough smoothing scales, it was Gaussian. Like if I smooth the thing at like 8 megaparsec, it was Gaussian.
Non-Gaussianity, does it reconstruct the non-Gaussianity?
Sorry?
If you add non-Gaussianity to the initial condition?
Do you recover that? I did not check that. No. That's a good question. But I did not check that. Okay, so one place where you would probably use something like this is to do baryon acoustic oscillations. So these are the most promising probe for dark energy from galaxy clustering surveys. And just a brief primer on this is what these are like essentially pressure waves in the primordial BO fluid. So BO fluid, so where, yeah, so if you have a peak in the primordial density field that expands out with the photons, at the point of decoupling, you have the baryons and photons decoupling from each other, after which photons propagate while the baryons remain fixed at that point. And that gives you clustering at a preferred scale when you go and do your galaxy clustering observations here. So while you would expect this to be a well-defined peak in primordial field, due to nonlinear evolution, it gets washed out. And the way people do it, the way people do analysis today is they use standard reconstruction to undo this nonlinear evolution and sharpen the peak back, which essentially gets back some significance on the peak. So that's exactly what we are doing here, because we are reconstructing the initial field. We are, in principle, undoing the nonlinear evolution. And so what I'm showing here is essentially cross-correlation between the true initial field and the reconstructed initial field by our method in the solid lines and by the standard reconstruction in the dashed lines for two different number densities. So most of the gain that we get is between KF.1 and KF.4. And if you go back and do some Fisher calculation on like how much is the significant, how much is the information content for getting back that BO peak, this is what you get. So if you take your observed data directly and do not do anything, this is how much Fisher information it has. If you get the correct linear field, this is what you have. So this is the best you can do. Standard reconstruction takes you there. Our reconstruction method takes you here, which is kind of like 20 to 30% more than the standard reconstruction. And the Fisher information content turns out to be r to the power 4. So that's why the gain that you have, which might look minimal, is actually quite a lot in terms of information content. Right. But, question? Yeah.
So I have a question. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have a way of modeling basically the entire nonlinear evolution. Basically, I mean, your forward model, you go from linear initial conditions to the Hilbert distribution.
Yeah.
So, the BAEO geometric information is just a subset of all the information.
Yes. Yeah.
So, I guess the question I have is, I mean, of course, you have more information in the entire reconstruction. I guess what fraction of that is the BAEO information?
Are you kind of asking that?
I mean, why do we have to separate the BAEO information?
No. So I'm not. This is just one thing. The objective at the end. This is the lowest hanging fruit that you can do this. The final goal that we have is to use the full broadband of the initial conditions that you have reconstructed and do cosmology with that.
Right.
But to do that, if you notice all the things that I've been talking about so far, they get a map estimate of the initial conditions. That's just the one point, one estimate, right? You need to get error bars and the variance on the reconstructed field. And then you need to make it agnostic to, and then you like need to do that again and again. Or somehow in a simulation-based inference to get the cosmological parameters. So I agree with you that the end goal is that, but it's a long road. We're not close to that.
Okay.
We have some basic approaches of getting error estimates using Laplace approximation around the map and stuff, but it's still a long road to that. So these are just, the whole point of this approach is that, yes, that's the end goal, but in the meantime, you have a lot of other things that you can use this kind of approach for. So, yeah, you would like that, that's fine. Okay, so far I was talking about this in real space, but since you're doing forward modeling, you also reconstruct the velocity field. So you can do the reconstruction in redshift space. So what I'm showing here is essentially the scatter plot between the halo velocity from my reconstructed field from the true dark matter field on this figure and the reconstructed dark matter field here against the true halo velocity. So the true halo velocity is the velocity of the center of mass of the halo. And on point by point, like on a object by object basis, you have 90% correlation. Which is almost as good as you would get from a true dark matter field. And so what you can do now is essentially displace your halos into the redshift space and do a reconstruction there. And this is what you get. So again, the same figure, except now it's along the line of sight and perpendicular to the line of sight. The dashed line is standard reconstruction and the solid is the R method. And in this case, you gain a lot as compared to the beginning. So along the line of sight, you gain a lot, and perpendicular to the line of sight, you have the gains, which are like similar to the real space, because that's pretty much the same. And then this has other applications, such that you can use this to get the velocity power spectrum. You can use this to undo redshift space distortions and do a full broadband clustering analysis if you're interested in real space. Or you can like play along and put it together with KZ and different kind of applications, depending on your interest. So this was basically galaxy clustering. You have questions up to this point? Yeah.
Are you just trying to remove the redshift space distortions, or are you trying to go and evolve to it?
In this case, for this figure, what I've done is essentially evolve to the redshift space and not undo redshift space distortion. So in this case, my neural network predicts halos in the real space, and then whatever estimate I have for the velocity from that step of my iteration, I just move my halos to the redshift space with that velocity estimate, and then compare it to the data. What I'm saying here is that if people want to, like, over the last couple of months, there were some papers which were using perturbation theory to do full broadband analysis in the Eulerian field, and the limiting factor for them was redshift space distortion. So what I'm saying that if people want, they can maybe use something like this. These are like just, I haven't done any of these. This is just, I'm throwing out that potential applications that can be done with this.
Does this improve BO measurement? Is that something you can immediately apply to measuring cosmological parameters, or is there unmodeled dependencies on cosmological parameters that you've extracted your result and means that that's...
So the good point about this is that most of the BO analysis that people do is at fixed cosmology, which is probably why I'm showing this as one of the most immediate applications, because making this insensitive to cosmology is the next thing that we want to do, but it might, like... it will be a long-term thing. So just doing a BA analysis, which is done at fixed cosmology, is probably the lowest hanging fruit that you can do. So yeah, in future, I plan to like approach, put something like this for like analysis of DESI or, for analysis of DESI at the lowest level.
Okay, thank
you. Okay, so the next question is, can we do better? So this is the last part of the talk, and all of this is, work in progress, and these are just things that I've been thinking about for the last 6 months, so all of this is super preliminary. But, so one thing that we have so far, both the forward models that I showed were essentially deterministic and were actually getting a one-point estimate of the, there was no stochasticity in there. So the way you can probably do better is essentially if you learn what is the probability of getting your observations given a dark matter. One place where it helps is, so the other thing you might have noticed is the loss function that I've used is quite heuristic, like there's no reason why this should be the case. It's Gaussian and it's diagonal in the Gaussian space. It's a diagonal Gaussian, both of which I know for a fact are wrong assumptions given the data, but kind of works. So it's some kind of residual function, but it's not the optimal likelihood function. So one thing you can do is essentially learn the likelihood. One way of doing that is use a mixture density kind of network. What this does is you parameterize the likelihood of your observations given a latent field in some distribution function, and you try to learn the parameters of that function with a Gaussian, convolution network. And so since you are using a mixture model and since you have flexibility of using any parametric form, you can go beyond Gaussians in this case. You can also use something like Pixel CNN, which essentially models the probability of your data as a product of conditionals. So what you have is that the probability of every pixel here depends on all the pixels coming before it and a latent field. So what you have done in this case is explicitly introduce correlations in your data so you can go beyond the diagonal assumptions that you make. And given such a likelihood model, you can also sample from these things to generate mocks. So what I'm showing here is essentially I trained a mixture density network without any optimization. It was just simple five-layer residual network, zero cleverness involved. And I just sampled a halo density field from that. And what I'm showing here, so one of these is, okay, I forgot which one is true, density field, and one of them is the sample, but that is the entire point. And if you calculate the correlation and the transfer function between these two, this is, it's more than 90% up to KF1, 80% up to KF1. So the point being, with these kind of models, you can firstly extend to much smaller scales than you would with the other models. Secondly, you can go beyond the diagonal Gaussian likelihood assumptions that generally are made in this kind of exercise. The problem here is then what you need is differentiable simulations which interface with the deep learning network. So this is something what I've been working on for the last couple of months is essentially FlowPM, a particle mesh simulation in TensorFlow. So this is the initial, this is the entire code, this is the initial conditions, and this is the PM simulation running in the browser live at the background. And this is all that you need. So you just generate the initial conditions. You define how many time steps you need. You define the cube size. You define the box size. You can simulate multiple universes at the same time if you want. And you just generate the initial LPT conditions for the initial displacements. run the n-body, and then put it on the grid to get, and then just run the graph in TensorFlow. So this is all you need to run a simulation. The money plot is this. So what you need to do the reconstruction, you just need this much of the code in that case. What I've done here is made my linear field a variable. The rest of the thing is same. I'm generating the initial condition, doing n-body, putting it on the grid. And then I'm just like, if my likelihood is Gaussian, then I just subtract it from my data. And that's essentially my likelihood function. I combine it with my prior, which is just like S square over the prior. And then I put it, I can use the optimizers, which are in TensorFlow to do the reconstruction here by just calling optimizer.minimize. If you have a deep learning element, so if you have a mixture density network or a pixel CNN, which is learning the likelihood, you just uncomment this line and comment this line. So that should essentially give you the likelihood from the pre-trained deep network that you should be able to do for reconstruction. And so this is going back to the first part of my talk where I said like you need differentiable forward models to do simulation-based inference if you are interested in doing forward modeling all the way. So this is kind of a step towards that. So this is not only for like doing the reconstruction the way I've showed, but this goes back to a broader scheme of things, which I was talking about. Because with this, you can get gradients with respect to each and every component, even which are like inside the n-body simulation, not only the initial conditions. So you can use those kind of things to do simulation-based inference. Of course, this is not there yet, because the thing that I showed about is only for one GPU, and for any kind of analysis, the single GPU RAM is not enough. So what you need is a parallel processing for this. And what you need to do is like shift from data. So mostly people in machine learning, when they parallelize things, they do data parallelism. So they have different batches on different ranks, and each of them is getting trained independently, and you just combine the gradients for that. We cannot do that. What we need is model parallelism, because you need to split up your mesh, or like in TensorFlow, you'll have to split your tensor across different ranks, as I'm showing here. So since last year, that is kind of possible. They have a framework called Mesh TensorFlow, which where you define a mesh, which is n-dimensional processors. So you define a layout for your processors. I have four processors in this case. And then you, for every tensor that you have in your simulation or in your model, you name the dimensions. So I've named my dimension as like B, D, I, D, H, and things like that. And then you define a computational layout, which essentially says in which mesh direction, which direction of my tensor is going to be split. So that's kind of what I'm doing here, that I've split my batch dimension in R and like DH dimension along C, and I've not split my DI dimension in any of those cases. So these are details, but the point being that that is possible. However, the main bottleneck is 3D FFTs. So if you have done PM simulations on distributed processing, this is where you spend more than 50% of the time in not any simulation. And this is despite them being like super optimized over the last 50 years at this point. Mesh TensorFlow is 2 years old, and it does not have optimized FFTs at all. So the situation is much worse than spending 50% of the time. So what we are exploring is basically some multi-grid scheme for PM simulations, where the idea being for the large scale forces, you use some coarse grid so that the FFTs are faster for that. And for the small scale forces, you do not need any kind of communication. So they are like individual FFTs. The scheme that we are using is Laplacian image pyramids to split scales. So this is just showing an example for that. So this is the initial density field. This is the reference which I ran on like one GPU. This is with the pyramid split, and this is the residual between these two. And so far for these small boxes that we tried, this seems to work very well. So this is way below 0.1% accuracy if I calculate the transfer function and cross-correlation. But this is still super preliminary, and yeah, we need to invest more time in this. But right, so this was my summary. These were the three topics I tried to cover during the talk. I'll leave this here, and yeah, any questions?
Yeah. So you said that the optimization actually was non-trivial. You said you could talk about this later. Can you say a few words?
Essentially, if I go back to one of the loss functions, I actually had slides for that, which I removed yesterday because I thought I'll not have time. So if you look at the loss function here, what essentially happens is because of the simply volume effects, what happens is you have way many more modes on the small scales than you have on the large scales, right? So if you just throw an optimizer to optimize this, what it ends up doing is like try to move the small scales a lot and does not touch the large scale. And what that happens is like you do not reconstruct anything on the large scales, while on the small scale it keeps on adding a lot of power. But that will get you nowhere because that's not how n-body simulations work. So one thing that we ended up doing is essentially you take this function and then you smooth it on the small scales. So once you have smoothed it on the small scales, the likelihood is not contributing any information there, and the prior is pulling those modes down. So that essentially forces your optimizer to reconstruct the large scales first, and then as you progress, you successively reduce the smoothing scales, so you push the reconstruction to smaller scales. So for this exercise, what we ended up doing is essentially use that kind of smoothing, plus we also used multi-grid scheme. So I first ran a simulation, like I first did reconstruction on a 256 cube grid, converged there, and then started from those initial conditions to a 512 cube grid, and then did a reconstruction there. I could have gone further, but we thought like this was good enough for our purposes. For the galaxy clustering, I had that smoothing, plus I had this M0 factor that I was telling you about. Where is it? Yeah. So this M0 factor, so I started with M0 of 10 to the power 12. What essentially that does is like suppress all the small halos below that. And that's good because I know that my neural network model is more accurate for large mass halos than small mass halos. Plus the large scale information is mostly driven by those large mass halos because I have mass weighting here. So so I start with large M0 and then I keep on decreasing that. The third annealing scheme that I used here is because I have this classification network. The last layer of this is a sigmoid function, and it was a much sharper sigmoid than a normal sigmoid function. Like I had multiplied the scale factor by something. So I varied that multiplicative factor in my model for this. So I start with a much broader sigmoid. So these things are like not discrete in the beginning. It's a continuous field. And then I progressively shrink the width of the sigmoid. So the whole point being that if my model is predicting a halo here, but not here, it should have the gradient information in that direction. Like I need to move in this direction. So it's easier to do that in a smooth field than a discrete field. So yeah, depending on the forward model, we came up with adiabatic schemes like this. So the reason I'm not showing reconstruction with this kind of scheme, like I have this implemented. The reason I'm not showing reconstruction from this kind of scheme is because I do not have an adiabatic scheme for this. So when I'm using my mixture density network to do reconstruction, I'm seeing the same thing, that it's adding a lot of power on the small scales. And so it gets the data back, but the initial field does not look correct. So that's the secret, that why I have no results for this yet. But yeah.
So how detailed do you have to model all of the systematics in a realistic scenario in order for any of this to be useful?
So in that sense, I have thought mostly about, to answer that question, I haven't thought that much about the intensity mapping yet, because we assumed that it was far away into the future. So I'll come back to that later. I've given some thought for the galaxy clustering thing there, especially for doing BAO, because the results I've shown are for the halo mass information, which you do not get in a real survey. What you observe is stellar mass, and then there's some scatter between that. So I think that's probably the most mitigating factor here. Because it's a forward model, because it's a forward model and the noise is in configuration space, I don't expect forward masks and those kind of like survey masks to be a big problem in that sense. But the scatter is essentially what might mitigate us at the end. So for now, it seems like if you have a scatter of 0.3 dec in halo mass, it should not impact a lot. But currently, people are claiming that 0.4 or 0.5 is more reasonably expected. So yeah, so that's where I'm investing my time in to basically make it more robust to stellar mass contamination. And then there are other things like fiber collisions and stuff, which I've not thought about that yet. But the whole point of keeping the noise in the configuration space was that I should be able to put a model of that as like a next layer. And but yeah, without trying the reconstruction of that, I don't have much intuition of how much that would kill us. But so far, we are hoping not that much.
Can you take into account the redshift evolution of your galaxy survey?
So all the results I showed were for redshift zero. So this is, I haven't taken that into account yet. But I presume that should be possible with the forward modeling step. The results right now are for a periodic box at a constant redshift snapshot. But that's a good point. I didn't think about that. But I have a feeling, again, it should be straightforward. Anything that deals with the forward evolution, I'm hoping would be straightforward. It would just like, how it will affect the results, I don't have an intuition of. But just throwing it in the model should be not that hard. But yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about that.
All right, let's thank
Jerry
again.
Thanks.